Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus, we will spend some time talking about the life and work of a man who is widely considered to be the greatest cartoonist to come out of World War II, Bill Mauldin. He won a lot of recognition for his work, including two Pulitzers, but I think probably to him the thing that mattered most was the admiration of the men who served in the infantry during World War II, the men whose experiences Mauldin documented, represented in the two iconic soldiers, Willie and Joe. No doubt you have seen some of those cartoons. This morning in this part of Focus, we'll talk with Todd DePastino. He is the author of a newly published biography of Bill Mauldin. The title of his book is Bill Mauldin, A Life Up Front. It's published by W.W. Norton, and it's just out now. So if you're interested, you can head out to the bookstore and look for the book. In addition, our guest is the author of Citizen Hobo, How a Century of Homelessness Shaped America. He's also the general editor of the cartoon collection Willie and Joe, The World War II Years. And he's joining us by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. Around Illinois and Indiana, if you're listening on the air, or anywhere in the country, if you're listening on the internet, and that's 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. DePastino, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The place that I thought I would start here is actually with the story that you tell at the beginning, which comes at the end of Mauldin's life, and I think has a lot to say about how men who fought, those men who were the real Willie and Joes in World War II, how they felt about Mauldin and about his cartoons.
They revered him, and in the end, they were the people most important to Bill Mauldin. It's hard to overstate how important Bill Mauldin was and still is to those who were in combat in Army infantry in World War II. My local paper here in Pittsburgh did a review of the book, and a few days ago, and that afternoon, I got a phone call from a man who said he just wanted to talk to me because he was one of those dog faces in World War II. And he opened the paper, and he saw a Bill Mauldin cartoon, and he read the article, and it just all came flooding back to him. And it turns out he was a POW taken prisoner at the Battle of the Bulge, and he was Jewish and had his dog tags replaced, and during the conversation, which was pretty brief, he broke down and started crying. And his wife just told me the rest of his story. And that has happened at least a dozen times over the course of my research on this book.
And what's really touching and in a way kind of sad, but it was at the end of his life when Mauldin was, it was in a nursing home. He was in California. He had Alzheimer's disease.
Yes.
That someone of this generation, one of these guys, somehow got word of the fact that he was there and went to see him.
Yes.
And then others went, and apparently a lot of guys went to see him and just to sit with him at the end of his life.
Yeah, he was in a nursing home in Orange County, California, and it was a bad ending. I mean, he was an alcoholic, which certainly didn't help his Alzheimer's. He had been in a scalding accident in a bathtub. He was in very bad shape, pretty much catatonic at the end of his life. And there he was in a nursing home. And somebody, one old veteran who had wanted to get in touch with him, didn't know he was ill, found out that he was in the nursing home and took it upon himself to visit him, wearing his old uniform, and pinned a combat infantry badge on Bill Mauldin, on his pajamas. And it was the only time that Bill Mauldin changed his expression. A big smile came across his face. And this old soldier decided that he had to get some of his comrades, old comrades, to come visit him. And a reporter for the Orange County Register, Gordon Dillow, ended up just writing an article saying, hey, Bill Mauldin is dying, and he seems to respond to old soldiers. So anybody who wants to come visit him, please, you know, get in touch with me, and I'll arrange it. So many, hundreds of these old veterans, some coming from, you know, as far away as Ohio, volunteered to come visit Bill Malden, so many that most of them had to be turned away. So instead they wrote. They wrote letters and they wrote cards, and the family lost count, of those cards at about 10,000. And I've read some of them, and they're incredibly moving. One that I'll never forget was written in spidery hand by an older woman who thanked Bill Malden. She was a war widow from 1944. Her husband had died in combat in 1944. She wanted to thank him for buoying his spirits before he was killed. And it just struck me how, first of all, how fresh this wound was that this woman still had, how fresh her grief still was from 60 years earlier, and how intimately connected Bill Malden was to her grief. He spoke for the grunts. He spoke for those on the front lines in a way that nobody else did. And it's as if he had completely identified with them.
The reason, obviously, quite obviously, and if you see the cartoons and people know them, the reason that these guys thought so much of him and identified with the cartoons is that he was documenting their everyday experience. He was showing them where they were, and they responded to that. And for that reason, though, the brass, the higher-ups, a lot of them, didn't like Malden, didn't like the cartoons, because the men looked kind of bedraggled and worn and looked like they hadn't shaved in a long time. And it was obvious that the experience for them was tough. And that was not, at least for a lot of people in the at the higher levels of command in the American military, that was not the kind of image of the American serviceman that they would like people to have.
Absolutely not. I mean, I just read recently John Steinbeck, who was a correspondent during World War II, said, you know, all of our servicemen had to be brave and clean-cut and honorable, and there was never such a thing as a coward or somebody who didn't want to be in combat. Bill Malden knew otherwise, as did the men who were in combat, and he drew it like it was. He was one of them. He was a rifleman. He had joined the pre-war army and was eventually into an infantry company. And by the time he landed in Sicily, he had determined that he would try to avoid combat by full-time cartooning for the division newspaper. So he always saw himself as somebody who connived to get out of combat. Once he saw how horrible combat was and that everybody in his company was wounded or killed, he felt that he owed them something. And he dedicated himself to depicting their lives in a way that nobody else did. And that did anger a lot of brass. You know, the interesting thing is, in 1943, when Bill Malden was sent overseas, Americans back home really didn't have much of an idea of what combat infantry life was like. All they had really seen depicted were the elite units, you know, the Marines, paratroopers, the Navy, and certainly the flyboys. There were no movies about combat infantry, about Army infantry. All the movies even the Merchant Marines had their movie, had action in the North Atlantic with Humphrey Bogart. Construction battalions had their movie with John Wayne and the Seabees. But Army infantry did not have a movie. They were not really expected to play that big a role in the war. The war was expected to be won in the air and from the sea. And I think originally the Joint Victory Program, created by military experts on the eve of the war, presented their program for how to win this war to President Roosevelt. And I believe that program called for 215 Army divisions. And in the end, the Army only got 89. So those infantry divisions weren't really expected to win the war. Turns out, by 1943, military experts realized that they had been wrong and that Army infantry would be bearing the burden of this war. So consequently, those in the War Department and those in the Army kind of searched for, you know, an image of a hero, a kind of an icon, an Army infantry icon, one that was on par with, you know, the glamorous flyboys and the brave, handsome, rugged Marines who were gung-ho. And they didn't find it. What they got was Malden.
What did it tell you? Have you talked a little bit about one encounter with one particular soldier, George Patton, and what happened between the two of them, between Mauldin and Patton?
Patton never liked Mauldin. Patton was Mauldin's most vocal critic, and Patton first encountered Mauldin's cartoons in the 45th Division News, which was Mauldin's infantry newspaper, only one copy of which still exists in the world. And when Patton was in Sicily, he saw these cartoons, and he said, "Get rid of this guy," to the 45th Division commander, Troy Middleton. Middleton ignored it. Middleton liked Mauldin, knew how important Mauldin was to morale in the 45th Division, so refused to fire Mauldin. Patton eventually pressed the case to Middleton and said, "You have to get rid of this guy. These cartoons are subversive, and they're disrespectful." And it's interesting, what I've found in Patton's criticisms of the cartoons, it's not just the fact that the Willie and Joe or the prototypes of Willie and Joe are sarcastic, they're sardonic, they're not eager to join the fight, they're not respectful of authority. I think Patton really disliked them because they were disheveled, because they were out of uniform.
But they needed a shave.
They needed a shave. Their fatigues were wrinkled and torn. Their helmets weren't polished. And Patton was really a spit-and-polish general. It really struck me how important self-presentation was to Patton. And the fact that these Willie and Joe characters were so disheveled, I think, really offended him. And I think he would have succeeded in getting Mauldin kicked off the newspaper, and Mauldin would have kind of gone down in history as less than a footnote, but for the controversy that then erupted over Patton slapping two soldiers in military hospitals and threatening them with his revolver. That kind of distracted Patton from the Mauldin problem. But Mauldin and Patton did meet up later in the war, and that was even more hilarious confrontation, I think.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Todd DePastino. He's the author of a new biography of Bill Mauldin, probably the best known, the greatest cartoonist to come out of World War II, won two Pulitzer Prizes for his work after the war, went on to continue to be a cartoonist, a political cartoonist, worked for a number of years for the Sun-Times in Chicago. And if you're interested in reading the full story, you can look for the book Bill Mauldin, A Life Up Front. It's published by W.W. Norton. Of course, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It seems that if you look at the lives of a lot of people who become great cartoonists, it seems almost that they're just born to it, that very early they show talent drawing, and they are drawing cartoons, and it seems like that's what they want to do. And you know, maybe there are other people who start out that way who don't get to do that for a career. But in Mauldin's case, it seems to be that he was, in fact, one of these guys that almost was born to be a cartoonist.
He almost was born to be a cartoonist. Often, though, cartoonists are, especially in the early years, cartoonists saw themselves as kind of failed artists. But Mauldin wanted to be a cartoonist because he was poor. And it didn't take a degree. It didn't take extensive training. And you can make your pile of dough quickly. Mauldin came from a very rough environment in the desert southwest of New Mexico. His father was kind of a ne'er-do-well apple farmer who moved the family across the southwest at whim, it seemed. And Mauldin and his mother was emotionally unstable. And he left the family at age 14 to live on his own in a boarding house in Phoenix. And he was somebody who saw himself on a fast track. He was a genius. He was an odd kind of character. He had been very sickly as a child. He was small in stature. He had rickets as a baby because he couldn't take his mother's milk and wasn't taking any vitamin D And so he wasn't really valued much in that rough arena of rural enterprise in New Mexico. But he had a genius. And he had a genius in math and in science and in literature. He was reading kind of novels at age 4 or 5. And he was certainly extremely artistic. He had great hands. His grandmother always thought he might be a surgeon. But that was out of the question for a kid who ended up not even graduating high school. He took a cartooning correspondence course and began submitting to magazines. And the early cartoons aren't really, they don't show his real special genius. He was copying what he saw in magazines. Really, he only developed his special style in the Army, which he joined in 1940. The Army, for some reason, I think, gave him the structure, gave him the sense of belonging. The Army, for all its faults, and he hated the Army, really was his home. You know, I think about Bill Mauldin's relationship to the Army like many people's relationship to their families. You know, there's nobody you love more and more loyal to, and nobody who angers you more than members of your own family. That's kind of how he felt about the Army. He felt at home in the Army, and it's when he began depicting the everyday lives of infantry soldiers that his cartoons really became special and came to life.
He, as you say, he had these health problems when he was little, and as a boy he was small, and came out of this sort of hard scrabble existence. I'm looking at this picture of him that's on the jacket of the book. It's a great photo, and he's sitting and he's wearing Army fatigues, and he looks a little the worse for wear, kind of like Willie and Joe. He's wearing a helmet, he's holding a sketch pad, and he's drawing, and he looks like he's sitting in the ruins of a bombed out building, and he looks like he could be about 17 years old.
Yeah.
he has an impish quality to him, and I wonder how throughout his life the fact that he always probably looked younger than he was and was not a big guy, how that either worked for him or worked against him.
It was disarming. Everybody who finally met him couldn't believe that this kid who literally wasn't shaving in 1943 when he went to Sicily when he first saw that. That this kid did these incredibly mature cartoons. I mean, cartoons that were really works of art in a profoundly important way. He always looked young for his age, even when he was older in middle age. I'm sure George Patton was taken aback when he saw that the object of his ire was this kid who seemed like he was straight out of 10th grade.
Can you talk more about his feelings about the military, the fact that maybe for him, once he got in the Army, that this was a kind of a home almost that he had always been looking for?
Well, he joined the Army because he was hungry and needed shelter and needed clothing. He was unemployed. He was an unemployed high school dropout in 1940, and the Depression was still on, and he couldn't find a job in Phoenix, and so he joined the National Guard. He joined the National Guard, I believe, on September 4th, 1940, and it's a good thing that he did join then, because the National Guard was, that 45th Division, which was the National Guard, was federalized, that means made part of the United States Army, 4 days later. If Mauldin had tried to join 4 days later, he would have had a physical and he would have been rejected because he was so underweight. I mean, this was a frail little guy, but he made it. He said they kind of counted our eyes during our physical, and that was about it. And he deliberately joined a quartermaster regiment, 120th Quartermaster Regiment, and it turned out to be a huge mistake. He was immediately put to work kind of sorting socks and chopping wood and hauling water and washing trucks. There was no soldiering at all, and he really had a romantic kind of idea about soldiering. He had a romantic idea that he would kind of rise through the ranks and become a great soldier. He actually, as a kid, dreamed of going to West Point. A more kind of refined dream of his was somehow being able to combine his artistic talents with soldiering. Didn't quite know how that was going to work, but, he dreamed of it. And his dreams were pretty much shattered at Fort Sill in Oklahoma when he was found that kind of anything that he did to try and excel, any time he showed his talents or his native genius, he was slapped down for it. he discovered that that was the way of the Army, that you never outshine, you're never supposed to outshine anybody else. And he constantly did it. He was an expert at manual of arms, you know, the throwing around of the rifle. And he showed off one day, and his top kick sergeant punished him for it, put him on latrine duty, hauling a barrel of urine every morning. But he was really punished when, in the fall of 1940, the United States Army issued its first IQ test to everybody in the Army from the top down. And Bill Mauldin scored the highest in his regiment, and I believe the second highest in the 45th Division. And he was put on 64 straight days of KP duty. And that taught him that he had to hide his light under a bushel. But Bill Mauldin couldn't do that. I mean, this guy was very prideful, very much a show-off, and he was a troublemaker, and he just couldn't help himself. And he decided the quartermasters weren't for him, and he begged for a transfer into the infantry, which everybody thought he was crazy for doing. The infantry was worse than the quartermasters. It was a very hard life. But he did it. He joined the 180th Infantry Regiment of the 45th Infantry Division, and that became his true home. Because here were people who were really dedicated to soldiering. He greatly admired his fellows in Company K of the 180th Infantry Regiment. And it was an almost entirely Native American and Mexican American company. And the Native Americans were mainly Choctaw, but some Cherokee. And Bill Mauldin said these were the most educated people that he knew in the 45th Division. They had all gone to federally funded or non-profit Indian schools, and some of them had had some university training. He said the least educated people in the company were the white soldiers like him, who was a high school dropout. So he actually, Mauldin himself was part Native American, which he found out later. But he really identified with these kind of tough, rugged, educated outsiders who had something to prove, and he was right along with them.
Our guest in this part of Focus, Todd DePastino. He's the author of a new biography of the World War II cartoonist Bill Mauldin. The title is Bill Mauldin, A Life Up Front, published by W.W. Norton. And questions are welcome. We have somebody here who'd like to join in, and others, you certainly are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Someone calling from Cisna Park. This is our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Wonderful show. Just a wonderful show. I don't know how good my connection's going to be, so just a couple of quick comments, a question, I'll ring off.
Sure.
It's interesting what your guest was saying. I would think that the Army would value the intellect of a Bill Mauldin, but I suppose the Army's all about conformity, which is their loss, I suppose. But I was wondering if your guest knew if there was any place in the country that his work could be displayed, his cartoons could be viewed. And then also I was wondering about when he left the Army, went to work for the Sun-Times, did he redirect his wit and talents to cover the political arena, or what did he focus on in civilian life? And I'll go ahead and listen. Thanks.
All right. Well, certainly the answer to the second question is, yeah, he did. He became a political cartoonist, and no doubt continued to stick his finger in the eye of authority. There were certainly people in Chicago who would just assume that he'd probably dropped off the face of the earth.
Richard Daley, probably first among them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if it's big, hit it. That was his motto. He actually had a motto, and he lived with it. To answer the first question quickly, Bill Mauldin's cartoons can be seen in a permanent display in the 45th Infantry Division Museum in Oklahoma City. That museum owns over 200 of Bill Mauldin's most famous World War II cartoons. Secondly, sometimes the Library of Congress, which owns about 1,700 Bill Mauldin drawings, several dozen of his World War II cartoons, sometimes the Library of Congress has special exhibit of his work. What we tried to do in the book Willie and Joe, The World War II Years, which will be coming out next month. It's a two-volume slipcase edition. We collected every single Bill Mauldin World War II cartoon, and it turns out there were over 630 of them. about 300 of them are the famous ones that Mauldin fans have seen, and those were the Willie and Joe ones that appeared in Stars and Stripes. But there are over 300 other ones that appeared in the 45th Division News, were never reprinted elsewhere. Many of those that did appear in the Stars and Stripes with Willie and Joe were also never reprinted elsewhere. This is a complete collection, kind of displayed chronologically, so you could really see his development as an artist, as a soldier, and as a survivor of combat. Now, the second question about, was Mauldin able to translate that talent, that satirical, you know, impish genius, to civilian life? And the answer is yes, but it wasn't easy. He took a rather crooked path, if you read the biography after the war. He came home pretty disillusioned, and I'm very partial, actually, to his post-war work, to the work that he did, the syndicated work that he did for United Features Syndicate between June 1945 and January 1949. I think those cartoons contain some of his best work. They're very hard-hitting. They're almost like watching a film noir serial where the hero, Willie is depicted after the war more often than Joe. Willie, Mauldin always envisioned as older and wiser, about 10 years older than Joe. And Willie appears more often than Joe in the post-war cartoons. And he's a kind of lonely, isolated, disillusioned figure, standing in the shadows, doesn't know who to trust, looking for longing and sympathy, running up against the power structure everywhere he looks. After the war, Mauldin really became politically radicalized. He embraced civil rights strongly, not only for African Americans, but for Jewish Americans and displaced persons from Europe. He really opposed the growing kind of anti-communist hysteria and the new Red Scare that was developing after World War II. Very much opposed that, the kind of burgeoning McCarthyism. He supported open immigration policies. He's generally supportive of labor. And his cartoons became very controversial, very. United Features Syndicate censored several dozen of his cartoons after the war. They changed captions. They whited out symbols in his cartoons. They whited out entire characters. And Mauldin got in a big battle with them. Turns out he had signed the contract as a 23-year-old, hadn't really read it, and the syndicate was allowed to censor. And that just disillusioned him like nothing else. He felt he had lost his independence. He had lost his voice. He said at the time, you know, all my years in the Army, and for all the controversy, all the problems I got into in the Army with Patton and others, I was only censored three times, he said. Said he was censored, and all three times had to do with him very accurately reproducing images of weapons and technology that hadn't been disclosed yet. So it was never for his point of view, it was never for his politics. The Army pretty much gave him free rein. Of course, he did censor himself, and that's another story. But after the war, he felt a kind of a clamping down of free speech that he hadn't experienced in the Army, and it was very disillusioning for him. And so he dropped out of cartooning for 10 years. 10 years! I don't know any other cartoonist who's ever done that. Drop out for 10 years and then come back and almost immediately win a Pulitzer. But for 10 years, he wrote plays, he wrote novels, he acted in a Hollywood movie in The Red Badge of Courage with John Huston. He traveled to Korea as a correspondent. He ran for Congress and lost in 1956. And then in 1958, he returned to cartooning for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, did six cartoons a week there for 4 years, and then took the job at the Chicago Sun-Times and stayed there for about 30 years. And he did some of his best work in those years, in the 1950s, 1960s, or in the early 1970s, I think.
One of the things that he sort of experimented with, and somehow I guess it didn't really work or didn't really translate, was to bring Willie and Joe home,
right.
You know, to muster them out and then do cartoons about Willie and Joe in post-war life. And somehow that just didn't work.
Yeah, it didn't work. You know, some of them I think are wonderful. Some of them depict a kind of the problem of the returning veteran in a way that nothing else that I've seen has. Some of them I think he was really right on with. Some of them appear as if they were very hastily drawn and as if he was kind of churning them out. I think he was overstretched. He was going through a horrible divorce. He was working on the movie version of Upfront and wasn't happy with the way it was going. And he was involved in politics, giving speeches. He was on national radio giving speeches about how we have to, you know, live up to the ideals for which we fought the war. And I think he just felt that he had never really known civilian life before. I mean, last time he had been a civilian, he had been an 18-year-old high school dropout. And now here he was, a celebrity, a big celebrity, the most famous enlisted man to come home from the war, certainly, a millionaire. And I think he couldn't handle it. And I think some of the cartoons do show a kind of shoddy craftsmanship. And he caught himself immediately. Because if Bill Mauldin was anything, he was a craftsman. That's how he always viewed himself, not as an artist, but as a craftsman. And when he felt he was off his game or off his craft, then he shut down and retooled. And so I think you begin to see a kind of revival of his work beginning in late 1946 or so. I think he once again kind of comes back to the top of his form.
Well, again, questions from people who are listening are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And again, our guest is Todd DePastino. He's the author of a newly published biography of the World War II cartoonist Bill Mauldin. It's titled Bill Mauldin, A Life Up Front, and it's published by W.W. Norton. I guess one of the things that I hadn't realized, and I certainly was familiar with him as a cartoonist, and particularly with the Willie and Joe cartoons. I didn't know that he had done any acting. He was actually in a couple of movies. Interestingly enough, one of the movies that he was in was a war movie, but it was about the Civil War. It was not about World War II. He was in Red Badge of Courage.
Yeah, yeah.
And did he really, was there a point where he really thought seriously that was something that he might do as a career act?
Well, you know, and with his usual bluster, he said, I'm just doing it for the Jack, and I'm not going to make a career of this. He wanted everybody to know he wasn't making a career of this because, you know, in case he didn't do so well, he didn't want to be criticized. But John Huston approached him to do the film. Mauldin had two experiences with Hollywood before that. He had sold the rights to Upfront to International Pictures after the war, and very reluctantly sold for $50,000, I think, with more money promised if he appeared in it. And at the time, it was the biggest book deal ever made in Hollywood. And he had kind of helped advise on the writing of the script. The original script was wonderful. It was written by John Lardner and Ring Lardner Jr. I discovered it in the Library of Congress. I don't know if anybody has read it since 1945. And as I was leafing through the script, I couldn't believe how well Ring Lardner and John Lardner captured the spirit of Upfront. Mauldin had been reluctant to sell them. He hated Hollywood, hated the way Hollywood depicted war. He said, I'll agree to sell the rights to Upfront if my cartoons, and he had a book titled Upfront that was a New York Times bestseller. He said he'd sell the rights to it if there was no comedy, no romance, and no happy ending. And that pretty much ruled out Hollywood's formulas. But he succeeded in selling them anyhow. And sure enough, the script almost reflects that kind of goal. I mean, it's very dark humor. It's grotesque, but also very sensitive to the trauma of combat and what these combat soldiers had been through. Willie and Joe are, I think, faithfully represented in the script. The movie was never made. Ring Lardner soon got in trouble for refusing to answer questions the House on American Activities Committee. He was sent to prison, I think, and I think Danbury, Connecticut. And for that reason, the script had to be scrapped. And I think that was a disillusioning experience for Mauldin, just to go through, again, the problem of censorship. He had his second experience with work in film is he was hired as an advisor for a movie called Teresa, a Fred Zinnemann movie, and actually flew to Italy and kind of advised on, you know, how soldiers acted and what and equipment and so forth. And he, in typical Malden fashion, he took hold of the script and rewrote much of it and included a new character. And Fred Zinnemann asked him to play that character. And he did. It was a small part, but he did really well. And Zinnemann loved him. And so John Huston contacted him in 1950 to tell him that, in kind of his grandiose style, that he was going to make a picture that nobody else has ever made. This is going to be a picture without actors. And it's going to be the Red Badge of Courage, and it's going to be an edgy, an edgy film full of ambiguity about courage and honor and war. And he wanted Audie Murphy, the most decorated soldier in American history, to play the lead. And he wanted Bill Mauldin to play the loud soldier, kind of his sidekick. And Mauldin agreed to do it. And he went out to California, and it was a disaster almost from day one. Lillian Ross wrote a wonderful book about the making of Red Badge of Courage called Picture. And that's a wonderful read because it's a sample of kind of the descent of Hollywood, I think, into the Cold War, into the Cold War chill. There was trouble on the set from day one. Huston never had enough money. Audie Murphy was a mess. He was suffering from post-traumatic stress in a big way. Some days he couldn't say his lines. Some days he just sat almost catatonically. Some days he came in bruised and cut because he had been in a fight the day before. He was a wildcat, and he always felt like he had to prove himself through his physical courage. But Audie Murphy also had what made him such an attractive actor to Huston and others is if you ever see a picture of Audie Murphy, he's a very kind of slight, young-looking, sensitive kind of soul. And that quality comes across in his acting, and it actually came across in person. And Mauldin really took to that side. He really identified with Audie Murphy. But the filming was very difficult. And Mauldin didn't like taking direction. He never liked anybody telling him what to do, how to act. He didn't like sitting around. He was a kind of restless guy. And then when the filming was all done and the movie went into production, Dori Sherry, the producer at MGM, cut most of it, cut at least an hour from it, and because the Korean War had started. And the film, with its ambiguity about courage and honor and valor, just had enough of an anti-war edge that made Dori Sherry very nervous. So he cut out all hints of ambiguity from the film, cut it down to 69 minutes, and that was it for Mauldin. He never wanted to have anything to do with Hollywood again. John Huston always said that Red Badge of Courage was the best film he ever made, but it was ruined. And I don't believe anybody has ever found the original cut of that picture.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, our guest is Todd DePastino. He's the author of a new biography of Bill Mauldin, the cartoonist, Bill Mauldin, A Life Up Front, published by W.W. Norton. He is also the general editor of a cartoon collection, Willie and Joe, the World War II Years. So if you haven't seen these cartoons, or maybe you haven't seen them in a long time, you can look for this book, and it's coming, did you say next month?
Next month is coming. Okay. Yes, and it's, you know, that represented a different challenge than the biography. That represented tracking down these cartoons. As I said, many of the cartoons, I'd say about a fourth of the cartoons, I'd say, appear in the 45th Division News. There's only one full run of that paper that survived the war, and it's in Oklahoma City, in a museum vault. In addition to that, Mauldin had another cartoon. This is before he was sent overseas, that ran exclusively in the Oklahoma City Times, and then later in the Daily Oklahoman. And then as the 45th Division moved around the country for training, they went to Massachusetts and New York and Virginia and Texas, he would sell individual cartoons piecemeal to newspapers for $5 or $10 each. I mean, he was a $21 a month rifleman. He needed the money. But he never left any record of where he sent these. So there was a lot of detective work in tracking down these cartoons, and we had to search at least 10 different publications to find kind of the full run of Mauldin cartoons before he went overseas, and then get high-quality images of them. So the book is filled with high-quality images of all his cartoons, and then my job was to annotate the cartoons, which was much more difficult than I suspected. Combat infantry soldiers lived a very different life than what we do today. Malden never thought that anybody, when he was doing his cartoons overseas, Malden thought that nobody would ever see these cartoons except for the dog faces, those who were on the front lines. He was cartooning for them. He wasn't cartooning for the home front. He wasn't even cartooning for the rear echelon. He was cartooning for the guys at the front. And so the humor only makes sense if you're at the front. Once his cartoons started appearing in Stars and Stripes all over the world, except in MacArthur's theater. Douglas MacArthur didn't like him any more than Patton and wouldn't allow the cartoons to be in there. But once his cartoons started appearing in the different editions of Stars and Stripes in France and in Germany and elsewhere, in England, Malden started getting these angry or puzzled letters from soldiers saying, I don't understand the humor of this one cartoon. And Malden would always write back, that's because it took place, I'm in Naples. He always cartooned about where he was. You had to be in Naples to kind of get the humor. And those who were in Naples at that time loved the humor. So what I try to do is, you know, some of the cartoons are kind of puzzling. And it was a wonderful project for me to go back and try and figure out, okay, what is this cartoon saying? What did it mean to the soldiers at the time? And oftentimes you get these terrific stories. There are some that are now famous for, you have Willie and Joe standing in the street in Naples, and an officer, a clean-cut officer, is writing them a citation for being out of uniform. And Willie says, I'm sorry, sir, these buttons were shot off when we took this town. You had to understand that at that time in Naples, in the American base section in Naples, in the peninsular base section, I should say, in Naples, soldiers who were sent off the line down from the mountains for 4 days of leave were, it was standard policy for peninsular base section MPs to arrest these men, these dog faces, for being out of uniform. They were only let off the line if they were so mentally impaired that they were incapable of pulling the trigger, incapable of understanding orders, incapable of responding. They were given 4 days of rest, and they would come down to Naples. They would have their own feces all over them, torn, bloody shirts, hadn't bathed in weeks. And they looked like monsters. They were deranged. And they were an embarrassment, I think, to kind of base section personnel. And so they were thrown in jail, given a shower, given a shave, cleaned up, given a new set of new uniform, and then released from jail when the 4 days were up and sent back to the front. And that absolutely outraged Malden. Those guys who were in combat, there were so few of them, first of all. Out of the 16 million men and women who wore the uniform of the United States service branches in World War II, out of those 16 million, only a little more than 5% ever saw extended combat. The dog faces, those especially in Army infantry, saw the bulk of the fighting in World War II. And again, they had not been expected to play that big a role in the war, and so the Army never recruited that many of them. But because they ended up having to fight, especially in Italy, up the boot of Italy, and the Germans were so tenacious in their rear guard defense of Italy, that those combat soldiers were left in the line far longer than they should have been. I mean, they were left up there for 45, 60 days at a time, and nobody experienced that kind of exposure to combat without being killed, wounded, or seriously mentally impaired. And it was a trauma and an injustice that absolutely outraged and motivated Bill Malden during his Army career.
We're here to the point where we maybe have 3-4 minutes left. The reason that soldiers, infantrymen who had this experience responded to the cartoons is because they looked at those cartoons and they saw themselves. And the only way that that could happen is if Malden had been right there with them. Yeah. Which we knew that he was. But the thing was that I sort of have this image of Malden here as the troops sort of inch their way through the mud, fighting the enemy under fire, that here's Malden beside them with his sketch pad drawing. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know that I can quite get in my head the image of him with a rifle. Did he actually carry a gun and shoot it and take part in the fighting that he was depicting?
He carried a gun with him. He carried a gun with him mainly to protect his Jeep. I think he was the only enlisted man ever during the entire course of World War II that had been awarded a Jeep by Fifth Army Commander Mark Clark for his own personal use. And Jeeps were stolen at an enormous rate in Naples, and it was usually American servicemen who would steal them and sell them to the Italians. And he, as a poor kid from the Southwest, I mean, this Jeep was the most prized possession he had ever owned. He didn't really own it, but that was ever really his. And so he carried a weapon to protect the Jeep. There was only one time where he ever discharged his weapon during the war, and that's when he was approached in a mountain village by some Italian peasants who were starving. They had been trying to get at a diseased bull and to kill the bull, to eat the bull. And the bull was fighting them off, and they didn't have a gun. All they had were knives. So they saw this American soldier, Bill Mauldin, and they said, "Hey, could you shoot a bull for us?" And he didn't like doing it. He was actually kind of, even though he was a rural kid, he was kind of queasy about, he was very kind of sensitive about animals. But he did. He killed the bull, shot the bull, and the peasants pounced on it and carved it up. And that was the only time he discharged his weapon. His method for getting those experiences at the front were that he would visit. He would visit for as long as a week. He would live in the foxholes. He would live in the bunkers. He would stay at a medical aid station. And as the wounded came in, he generally would sketch ideas when it was quiet. But he wouldn't really, come up with the full cartoons. And then he would leave, get in his Jeep, and leave to the safe areas in the rear, especially to Naples. He had his own little room in Naples and his studio. And then he would take the handful of ideas that he got at the front, and he would sketch them into a series of cartoons, send them off to Stars and Stripes, or give them to his editor, who would then send them to New York City when he finally became syndicated. The syndicate would then make copies of them, send it back to Stars and Stripes in London, and then the cartoon would be distributed to Stars and Stripes all over Europe. So he was kind of always back and forth, shuttling back and forth from the front. And if anybody, from what I've read about the experience of combat, the scariest time during combat is when you're going back to the front. That is the scariest time. That's when you tend to get hit by artillery and mortar. Actually, at the front is rather quiet because it's small arms fire. It's very primitive and terrifying still. But once you leave combat, it's very hard to go back in. And I think that experience of having to go back in month after month after month just really wore him down, really traumatized him.
Is it true that he at one time had this idea that Willie and Joe would die?
Absolutely.
On the last day of the war, that they would be killed?
Absolutely. He was embarrassed because he felt he had actually soft-pedaled the war. He knew that he could never depict such things as traumatizing wounds. He knew that he could never depict what was called battle fatigue. Everybody he knew had battle fatigue. Battle fatigue is severe trauma where you pretty much emotionally and mentally shut down. He could never really depict that. Ernie Pyle tried to write about it, and he was censored. I mean, there was very serious censorship during the war, and Mauldin was smart enough, even at the age of 22, to censor himself. And he was so angry at having to censor himself that he determined that he was going to kill Willie and Joe because they were all dead anyhow. That's how he put it. Every one of them. I mean, he thought that he was doing a disservice to those dog faces by keeping Willie and Joe alive, because nobody could survive in combat for as long as they did in the cartoons. And his editor at Stars and Stripes told him that they would never print it. Never. So Mauldin didn't do it, and he reluctantly took Willie and Joe home with him. And he always felt guilty about that. Even very late in life, he said, "I should have just killed them."
Well, it's really clear that he communicated through his cartoons that the toll that the war took, and questions about it. For example, there's this cartoon here where it shows trudging along through the rain and the mud some German prisoners of war, and then right next to them is an American soldier. And the ironic cut line is, fresh spirited American troops, flushed with victory, are bringing in thousands of hungry, ragged, battle-weary prisoners. And of course, the question is, okay, which is which?
Yeah, you really have to look closely at that cartoon to see which are the German soldiers and which are the Americans. And that was, there is Bill Mauldin kind of puncturing the propaganda of World War II. And he did that with all his cartoons, just kind of, you know, puncturing the kind of glib depictions of clean-cut, righteous Americans fighting men. He knew that in combat, in war, war ground people down to a common, base, primitive level, whether enemy or friend. That's how he saw the war. He would often, in fact, many of his cartoons do depict Germans in very rather sympathetic light, except for the German officers. German officers he treated like he treated the American officers, but he always called the German soldiers Fritz, and they very much appear like Willie and Joe. They're sick of the war too, and they just want to go home.
Well, we're going to have to stop. It's a great story about an amazing, fascinating individual. So if you'd like to read more about the life and the work of cartoonist Bill Mauldin, the book is Bill Mauldin, A Life Up Front. It's published by W.W. Norton by our guest Todd DePastino. And also, if you're interested in sampling some of the work, you can look for the book that's coming up next month. He is the general editor of the cartoon collection Willie and Joe, The World War II Years. He teaches at Waynesburg College. He makes his home in Pittsburgh. Todd, thanks very much for talking
with us. Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.